start. It's 18 minutes after 2, so it's important. Yeah, for anybody that might need to know who I am, my name is Jorge Cervantes. That's a sobrenome or a pen name. And my given name is George Van Patten. I had to change my name for a pen name to stay out of jail make it across a lot of borders. I used to cross, well, I still do cross a lot of borders. The thing is, I don't know, especially people that are my age or contemporaries, you know how rough we've had it in the past, you know? I mean, I've been in this publicly for 32 years. My good friend over here, Tom Alexander, started a magazine, Scenes of Me and Tips, and he was rated back in, well, it was a Green Merchant. That day, lost the magazine, or lost all the advertisers. And we've been duking this stuff out for years. I mean, literally years. And we risk a lot. And I know a lot of people in this room have probably risked a lot. And I'll tell you, it's really great to be here and talk about cannabis openly. There was a guy we talked to earlier today that was from Tennessee, just moved out. And I said, "Do you grow?" And he looks around and he goes, "Well," and I said, you can say it, don't worry, you know, you can say it. So it's really nice to be in a legal state and things are changing, but we gotta pay attention. So what now it's legal, we've got a lot more little fights to fight. For example, the gay movement, they are just able to marry right now, nationally, and they've been fighting for years. The civil rights movement is still going really strong. We're gonna face a lot of these same obstacles. You know, so that's pretty much the political end. I'm really good with the growing. Some people call me an expert. I've just done a lot and had a lot of help from a lot of other people. I wanna tell you about my new book, this Cannabis Encyclopedia. It's 596 pages, 8.5 by 11 format. It's the sequel to my last book, The Marijuana Horticulture. So, I mean, it's not a sales thing. I just wanted to use it as a base. And the guy that wrote the foreword to the Cannabis Encyclopedia is Vicente Fox. And he's the president of Mexico. And his big thing is he wants to stop killing the children. There's 30 funerals every day. And most of these funerals are for people that are 25 years or younger. And it's pretty hard to see your country go down the tube like that. But the good thing is, Vicente said that he would grow cannabis in Mexico as soon as it is legal. And that's a big thing coming from an ex-president of Mexico. And also, he has the biggest farms in Mexico, in northern Mexico. He's the biggest, well, for example, biggest broccoli grower. And he could change a lot. He already has. But another thing is, a little background, you know, some years back, well, 1964, they discovered the THC molecule, and then a few years later, they discovered the CBD molecule. And look at this, 1964, they just discovered it. This plant was illegal since the 30s. But now, you know, they've got, and then later they discovered CB1 and CB2, the receptors. So there's an entire family of drugs that can be based on these two receptors, and they're everywhere. They're in the body. They first thought they were just in the brain, but they're all over the body, and they're all over animals too. Dogs, cats, and all the animals have them. So that tells us that cannabis evolved, or people evolved with cannabis. So we've got this relationship for millennia, and there's no reason it should have ever been illegal. And then there's also some other guys that have really helped a lot with this movement, like real strong guys, like Dennis Perone. He started the first San Francisco Buyers Club. And he, in, what was it, 1973, San Francisco police shot him. He didn't slow him down, he came back. And he was a co-author of Proposition 215, the first proposition that legalized medical cannabis in America. And a lot of times Dennis is forgotten. He's still with us and everything, but he's forgotten. A lot of other people have, well, taken credit for stuff. And it's a whole lot of people, a whole lot of people have been in this movement, and no one person can take credit for it. We're all just simple cogs in the wheel, and we need to remember that. Here's another old friend of mine, Bernard Rooney. He started the Mellow Yellow, the first coffee shop in the Netherlands, and he's an original hippie from the word go. Gosh, every time he started several businesses and a big publication, Soft Secrets. You might want to write that down, softsecrets.nl. That's, now it's the biggest magazine in the world, in Europe. Most people over here don't know about it. But I've known Bernard for years and years, and he started the Mellow Yellow, and now he is a major advocate for CBD and medicinal cannabis. He talks all over Netherlands and Europe, but mainly Netherlands. He doesn't talk great English. It's okay English, but for in front of people, it's not great. But good English, good enough for a talk, but mainly Netherlands. So it's interesting to see how it's gone from drug cannabis for recreation to medicinal. And he's like one of the biggest heroes in the world as far as I'm concerned. And very unassuming. Here's another couple of great guys. The one, let's see, on this side is Lawrence Ringo. And he passed away last year. Sorry to hear that. He had lung cancer and passed away really rapidly. But him and Jaime Carrion they're two major breeders for the cannabidiol or CBD, the no high part of the pot and or part of the plant. And Jaime Carrion he's a good friend from Spain, and he owns Resin Seeds. Very, very dear friend, wonderful guy. But please pay attention to those, especially him, Jaime, because he's going to be doing a lot of stuff. He bought a piece of land now in America in California. So he's going to be producing a lot. And cannabis testing. This is another thing that's changed, because all of the testing that used to be done before Proposition 215 in California was done by the police. It was forensic testing to see how potent this killer weed was, right? So that was all the information we were getting. Now, since Proposition 215, we've got testing for potency, testing for complete cannabinoid profile. They're starting to learn more about terpenes and testing for them. It's quite expensive, the terpene testing. The smaller the amount of terpene in something, the more expensive it is to test for it, because it's just got to be a more accurate test. But it's important to choose the proper lab. There's a lot of labs out here. There's the Work Center here, out there from LA, and apparently they've got another lab now in Bellingham or Bellevue. You can see the representative out here. But be careful when you are testing. There's a test called the ring test, and that was printed in on operator projectcbd.org. And they went around to different labs and did a double blind test to see how accurate the tests were. And a lot of them were way out of whack. So just because somebody says something doesn't mean it's true. Follow up and do your homework on these things. In my new book, that's why I chose. excuse me, Samantha Miller. She runs a testing lab. She wrote chapter 2 in this book, and she just knows way more about it than me. But please be careful when you look for a test lab. And here's a little bit of a vlog for her. Very good friend and just a wonderful scientist. Now here, we've got the medical varieties, and it's funny because there's all kinds of new varieties. So many people call them strains, but a strain is really a misnomer. A strain is for a lower plant, a plant that doesn't produce chlorophyll, like a mushroom, for example, or, or a bacteria or a fungi. Those are strains. These are actually varieties. But if you look at these varieties, I got these, the two photos, the African and the Afghani, I got those from Mel Frank, who wrote the Marijuana Grower's Guide. And you can see these plants, the African, it needs to be worked up quite a bit. It's the buds are quite small on it, but it was very, very potent even back then. The growers have just developed better varieties. They've worked them up genetically, so they're more consistent. But the Afghani, I mean, that looks very similar to a lot of Afghanis today. And there's many different Afghanis. There's basically four different Afghanis that came over in the early 80s. And then Canatani, the last plant, that plant was trimmed up and everything for the photo. But Canatani is a mix of MK Ultra times G13 that was crossed before with a haze plant. But it started a CBD revolution, though. The Canatonic and Sour Tsunami, these early plants. And you may have heard of the other one, Charlotte's Web. And something I can't say strong enough now is you can test for this stuff early on. Samantha Miller has done she's got a series of tests you can put plants through, and they can figure out if the plant will produce more CBD or has a higher level of CBD by doing a genetic test. And when somebody tells you that there's only one or two types of plants that will produce CBD and they're special and only they have them, they're full of shit. That's all there is to it. They are lying. And they were doing that for money. There's a lot of plants that can produce CBD. It's just the plant was bred for a high THC drug content rather than a high CBD drug content. And even within the last couple of years, we've seen many, many new CBD varieties. So that's really important. Don't let somebody pull your leg there. And we've also seen a lot of things, and I really like this. I really started with indoor growing because, well, that's what we could do and not get caught. And here on the one side is a garden in Spain, just north of Barcelona. And you see the anarchist flag in the back. And, you know, but growing indoors, people do a lot here. You grow great, outstanding cannabis indoors, but it's incredibly expensive. And the price of cannabis is going to go down, continually go down. So in order to be competitive in the marketplace, you're going to need to lower your costs of production. That means you don't buy these real expensive fertilizers and all the new products. You just keep things very, very simple. And one of the ways to keep things simple is to use one of these light deprivation greenhouses here. And all that means is that you cover the plants so they get 12 hours of uninterrupted darkness. And by doing that, you can get, even in this climate, up to 3 crops a year. The first crop will be a bit small because it's not as bright outside. The second crop in the middle of summer or late summer will be the strongest and the most productive. And then the last fall crop will be about like the spring crop is. And I don't know if you've heard about it, you might want to write this down too. There's the Golden Tarp Awards, and that's September 12th in Garberville. And it's the second annual, and well, it's really changed the cannabis industry. Because now there's 3 harvests outdoors, and it costs way less to produce these plants. And there's nothing like the sunlight, because it's got UV, ultraviolet light in it. And what that does is makes tougher, stronger plants that grow better. And the other thing here is if there's an MF after any of these, that means it was taken by Mel Frank, who's just been a wonderful friend and a mentor of mine for years. But seeds hold the key to the cannabinoid profile. And most often here, we don't use seeds, we use cuttings or clones, stem cuttings technically, or clones. And there's some real big problems with clones because they can have powdery mildew in them and you don't know about it. But you can have a limited amount of genetics available if you just have clones. So going back to seed at least once every couple of years is quite important. And here's another one. This one was taken from, anybody know the seed bank, the old seed bank from Netherlands? That was an Australian guy, Neville Schumacher, that moved up and went down in High Tides. Well, he took this picture right here. It's taken in Hungary alongside the highway. This is one of the first ruderalis, cannabis ruderalis. You've got the sativa, cannabis indica, and those are both daylight sensitive. They need 12 hours of uninterrupted darkness to flower. But the cannabis ruderalis is daylight neutral. It'd be like the strawberries, daylight neutral strawberries, or well, most plants out there, and the others would be well, like a Napa cabbage or a chrysanthemum or a poinsettia. But you can see the date on this, that's 1987. I remember hanging out with Neville a lot back in the old days, and he kept trying to work this plant up, but there was just no market for it. Now they've turned it into an auto flowering plant, which means it'll flower after approximately 3 weeks of growth, flowering starts. They're really popular in Europe. I don't know if they'll catch on real well here because we've got plant limits. And the plant limits means you want to get as big a plant as possible. And strong seeds, can't say enough about it. And taking care of them, it's just like a little baby. The first 3 years of life are the most formative, the most important. Up to 6 years, they've pretty much got everything in their head that they need to survive throughout life. Same with the seed. If you don't have a good start on those plants and that plant's abused right at first, you're gonna have trouble throughout the life. And especially if you grow indoors, you don't have very long for that plant to recover. And if it gets stunted in, it's not gonna do very well at all. Here's another one. Strong vegetative growth is super important. A lot of people don't pay so much attention to that, but you have strong vegetative growth and you're gonna have a great crop. So it's important every second, every minute of that plant's life. And here's Jaime Gallon and Elizabeth and Lina Ricon of Noruegas. They're from Norway. They live now in Spain. And you know, old friends, I put my friends in. Here's another one that you might try, especially if you grow indoors or outdoors. If you grow indoors, you might just do this with one plant or a part of a plant. What they do is they just pollinate one lower branch, and this is marked right here. They mark that branch as pollinated so it won't be harvested because there's quite a few people out there harvesting. And that's all the seeds you need for your subsequent year. It's kind of a loose way to acclimate plants, but, well, I've got other photos in the book, and then if we go long enough, I've got photos of some of the plants there. They grow up to 10 pounds, but it's really important, especially if you grow outside, that the plants are acclimating. But that's a great way to do it. You just put a bag over this full of pollen, shake it up, leave it on there overnight, and the plant pollinates, and then you take it off, you wet everything down. As soon as you wet that plant or wet that pollen down, it's rendered useless at that point. And here we go with stem cuttings. All you do when you put this, my favorite product for this is Dip and Grow, because it's liquid, it's really simple to use, it's incredibly inexpensive, and all the commercial nurseries use it. It's good for hardwood cuttings, softwood cuttings, and anyway, all this root-inducing hormone does is it makes undifferentiated growth here. And that undifferentiated growth means the plant was green before, and now it's got to turn white into a root. So that's pretty hard for a plant to figure out. It takes it about a week to 10 days to figure that out. If you put the hormone on it, it speeds up the process. But actually, you don't even need a hormone. And there's a lot of talk about tissue culture that's just starting. This was taken by a friend of mine. These are calluses. But the tissue culture, like the clones, it really would be tissue culture, but it's an exact genetic replica of the plant. This was taken by a friend of mine, Ernesto, that owns hemp trading in Valencia, Spain, and he's like a real funny guy. He's pretty kind of a squirrely guy, always making jokes on people. But he was the black sheep of the family. It's probably a lot of people in here are the black sheep of the family. Didn't, you know, the weird ones that didn't conform to stuff. I know I certainly fit that category. But he's got what? Two doctors and he's got four or three, two sisters and a brother. One sister and one brother are doctors, medical doctors, and the third one is a scientist, research scientist. Now they all work for Ernesto. Isn't that fun? Yeah, he makes them work hard. Here's just a practical note. You can take, if you have a plant that you really like and you want to save the genetics, it can still be flowering and it'll still turn into, you can still strike roots on it, or it'll strike roots. The deal is, it just takes longer. And it could be prone to disease and everything. The longer a plant stays in the ground indoors, or the longer it grows, the more problems you're gonna have with it. So that's why it's really good to get them in and out as soon as possible. But, you know, like I say, you can do that. This was taken over at Flowery Field, my good friend Alex Brocal. Well, I'm not supposed to say his last name. Anyway, at the time, this was taken, 4 years ago when I was over there hanging out with him. And they were doing about 15,000 clones a week little industrial section of Vienna, Austria. Because in Vienna, you can grow as many plants as you want. You can buy and sell them, everything. You just can't let them flower. So, like this, you know, he's got this huge operation going. And so he grows the cuttings and everybody buys them from him. But the thing is about this, and his manager is a guy named David, a German guy, and he's got blinders on pretty much. He keeps everything super clean. You gotta walk in a solution, gotta have clean clothes, everything, and you always wear gloves. Keeping everything clean when you're making cuttings is huge. You wanna make sure and keep it clean, because the plants can get several really big diseases, and you will not know that maybe for a generation or until the plant's flowering. And all of these guys over in Austria know each other, and so you can't make any mistakes. If you have a bad batch come out, you either make it right very, very quickly, or you're out of business. And we don't see that. I live in California, and there's a lot of things like that happen because the market is moving so fast. But cleanliness, I can't say enough about it. You gotta be very clean. There's another one, the flowers and the capitate stalk resin plants. So the peony purple, I just put this in because you can see all the resin glands here so well. And then here's another one close up. You can see several different stages here. You've got the stalk here and then the capitate stalk. And then the capitate part, that means it's a ball here on the top. And you can see these plants are getting ripe now. They're starting, the ball on top is starting to change color. That means it's senescing or slowly dying. Well, most of the drug content in cannabis is right here, in this area here, on those right at the base of the, right on top of the stalk and at the base of the capitate ball there. And this stuff is really, it's so tender, and it's easy to rupture that. And you see that all of these over here on the peony purple, they're all sticking out a lot. And it's really easy. So when you harvest plants, they're pretty tough right when you harvest them, but the longer they dry out, the more brittle everything gets. And you can rupture this here, and the potency, see, diminishes very quickly. So when you trim the plants, trim it and then hang it, rather than the other way around, or you're going to break these up, and the potency is going to suffer. And here's sealed rooms. This room here, there was two fires at this place. The first fire was in a sealed room in one of my friend's warehouses in Eduardo, from this Spanish guy moved to San Francisco. And he had a fire in this room. It was a sealed room. He had a spike come through the electrical system during a storm. And the room was sealed, and since the room was sealed, it ran out of oxygen and the fire put itself out. But it was one of those old warehouses south of Market Street that has, it's all made out of timber, right? Wood. So it would, and the wood's really dry, and it would go up and nothing flat. So what he did after that is he put right on top of here a fire extinguisher that's heat operated, and he puts it right over the ballast. And that worked pretty well to stop it. But later there was another fire about a year and a half later. Yeah, about a year and a half after the first fire. And that fire it ran through the whole warehouse. And Warlow, he's a black belt in judo. So he jumped out of the window and he sprained his ankle, that's all. He bruised his arm up pretty good, but he didn't have any broken legs. But John Williams, another fellow, went back to save the dogs because they had dogs there. John got burned on 52% of his body, and he can't lift over 30 pounds now, and that was a year and a half ago. So this that fire danger is very real, and you know, I know people that suffered a lot because of it, not just John. So please be careful. Here's another favorite one. Weird high-tech ideas. There's a lot of, it's not so prevalent as it used to be, but there's a lot of people, they talk a lot, you know, I've been to a lot of grow rooms, and they'd say things, you know, and then you go, okay, I want to go see the room. And they say, oh, yeah, sure. And the closer when you're driving to the room, it's always the same. They say things like, oh, you should have seen my last crop, or this other guy screwed me over and I have a problem with the crop. Well, when you get there, you realize there's some big incongruency, like a high-performance hydroponic system, and the plants need a lot of light and good ventilation to grow in here, but there's basic, super bad problems here. This is too high performance here for the amount of light that's available. This amount of light should be able to grow cuttings, that's it. And then the fan is directly oriented on the plants. Crazy, crazy for this kind of thing. You can get away with it in different situations, but don't listen to anybody unless they're an expert and they can prove it. That's the message there. Perpetual crops. Here's another one. This is by a friend of mine, a Spanish guy, in 2013. He took the photo of the cover on the book, and he also has a case study. It's about growing with high pressure sodium lamps and LED lamps. And this is in a small bedroom in Spain, just north of Valencia. And it's really a small room, but he's got it all set up. He does everything perfectly. The clones are up above because they need warmth underneath. The soil needs to be warm. So the roots will grow faster. If the soil is warm, at warmer than the ambient temperature by a couple of degrees, that's all it takes, 3 degrees, the roots grow quicker. So he takes advantage of that, and then here's the vegetative room, and he's got another one of these, the compact fluorescent lamps in it. I don't particularly care for this one, but it works fine for him. And then here's his flowering room. So he cranks out, gosh, I don't know how much, but it's always in production, always nonstop. And he grows a heck of a lot. He's got fibromyalgia, and at 40 years old, he's what, 55 now? And at 40 years old, he was just about ready to lose it. He lost his job, he had this horrid disease, nothing worked for him. He believed that cannabis was the worst horrid drug in the world. And when his health was compromised, he changed his mind. Now Tony is a regular functioning member. I mean, he's great. In fact, if you can't shut him up, he just keeps talking. He's a great guy. I mean, but he's so excited all the time. And you know, I love the guy. I love the guy. He's wonderful. Now, if you grow outside, which I don't know if I'll have enough time to talk about here, but. Yeah, the growing outside is really, really easy, but they have these wall waters here. And what it is just all these tubes that are hooked together, and then it's open around the top here, and you just pour water in there. Well, this was developed in at one of the universities in Utah, and you fill this up with water and put it around a plant, and it's a teepee. It opens and closes. You close it at night and open it during the day for ventilation. Well, you can hold your plants down to 24 degrees Fahrenheit with this, and you don't have to have electricity or anything involved, because when you close it at night, this is so cool, you close it at night, the water freezes, and when the water freezes and the temperature gets low, it releases energy. That energy is enough to keep that warm inside. And, you know, a few of those, you can start early, the plants get a good start, the roots go really deep, you have way fewer problems. You can really, and even if your ground is bad, you have, I can't say enough good things about starting early. And even though the plants aren't growing above ground, they're gonna grow below ground a lot. This one was taken, okay, next one, we'll go barrels of water. It's a simple way to heat the greenhouse. It functions as a heat bank. The water in the barrels heats up over time, and once it gets to a temperature, it stays there, and it stays warm at night, and keeps the greenhouse warm. And then the next day, because the air temperature drops quicker than the temperature of the water, so it's all you have to do is get some old barrels, make sure they're clean, fill them with water, and you've got a heater in your greenhouse. Now, this picture was taken in Mexico, one of the mafia farms I visited. And it's, well, see, Mexico City, it's quite far south, and they get about 12 and a half hours of daylight maximum. And the inverse is true for nighttime. So in order to get the plants to grow very big, they have to put light, or just a half hour of light at night to break up the night cycle. That'll keep them in vegetative stage. And so if that's the case for a spring crop, you're going to need these lights here. And they don't have to be big. These are CFL, small lamps, and a very low light level will keep the plants from flowering. I changed my tune on this, because before, I've written chapters about security and keeping your plants free from, well, so you won't get popped and go to jail, lose your kids, all of that stuff, lose all your assets, they take your home, they try you, or they used to try you twice in this country. But you can put up these cameras, and the green one up here, it's really interesting. This is a garden cam, but the hunters use that too. I don't think it's really fair for them to use them, but I'm not in charge of that. But anyway, you can get one of these garden cams, and you can set it on motion detect, and it'll detect anybody in the garden. If somebody comes over and wants to steal your plants. And one hint, though, is a lot of times criminals are pretty smart, a lot of times, some of them anyway. They wear a ball cap and you can't see their face. So you might want to mount two of these, one at lower so you can get their face. But it really helps. And then also, you can make a time-lapse video out of these. And if you do, set it for a half hour or an hour, otherwise you go through a lot of batteries. And this one is the regular security cam. It can be hooked up to your computer and in turn hooked up to your iPhone or Android. They're quite good, you know, and you can also hook it up to a loudspeaker, so you can turn that on and scare people out of your garden. And then there's the drones. The best way to get rid of a drone, especially if you're in the country, is to shoot it with a shotgun. And then it'll fix it. It won't come back. It won't come back. But you can use it to go over your crop. And if you make a time-lapse video, you can really get a good record of your garden over time and see if there's any problems. It's amazing. Here's another guy. This is XNARC. We're seeing a lot of people turn around. This is Barry Cooper. He used to be a narc in Texas. Now he lives in Mexico. And gosh, he's 100%. He's made a video called Never Get Busted. And he gives a lot of inside tips on all these dirty tricks the cops use, right? But it's good to see him. He's totally into tattoos, too. Meters. Can't say enough good things about meters. I was at a garden the other day. I said, well, what's, and they were having severe problems. And the guy says, well, I think it's the pH, and I think the water's off. And I said, well, what's it test out at? He goes, I don't know, I don't have a meter. And I said, you're talking to me, and you're telling me this, and you have no idea what you're talking about. If you go to the doctor, the first thing they do is give you a thermometer. Put the thermometer in your mouth. Check your temperature. You know, the difference between 103 temperature and 104 temperature is brain damage, 1 degree. Plants, it's a huge thing. Salt meter, 50 parts per million sodium in your water, and you're right next to the water here. So 50 parts per million sodium in your water blocks about half the nutrients in your plant. It doesn't matter how much you spend on fertilizer, it doesn't matter what your best guess is. You get a meter, and there's a good chapter on meters in here too. Basic meters, pH meter, EC or parts per million meter, thermometer, hygrometer, must have. And while I'm talking about that, here's another thing. I don't know, you really shouldn't look at this, but this is a UVC light. The cops use them, and so the hotel managers use them. You can, the cops use them for forensic testing, blood, any human fluids will show up that it'll like glow in the dark with this. So, and then also, you don't want to shine it around your hotel room if it's a dump, because you're gonna see a lot of fluids there that you probably don't want to see. The cool thing is about this, and I just ordered it up on the internet, right? It's like 20, 30 bucks, real inexpensive. You shine this on your plants at night, and you can see where all the bug trails are, all of the feces is, and any fungus before it enters the plant. It's really pretty amazing. I didn't know that until I was walking around the greenhouse with one of these green lights on my head, you know, making videos, silly videos. And there was a situation where there was powdery mildew, and you could see it on the leaves down below. And this grow room in Northern California, and then it wafted upstairs, followed the air upstairs, and it affected part of the plants, but just right beyond the door, right? So I went up there and I was looking with this green light, and I saw the plant, or I saw this fungus, and you could tell exactly where the path of that fungus was. It's cooler than heck. Well, the green light was good, but this is way better. I mean, it looks like it's like a black light, except more, but stronger. Really a cool, testing device to have. And 20 bucks, it'll save you tons of time, you won't guess. Here's another thing, you know, a lot of people are lazy. They look at all the money that's spent here. They've got that big fan, the ventilation system, all of this ducting, special lights. And then the things didn't line up, so they didn't try to fix it. They didn't spend any time doing that. They just put it in. And the guy that made this room, he was bragging to me. He grew cannabis for 13 years, and I don't think he learned too much because he's already making it. It was one of the worst grow rooms I've ever seen. It didn't. Well, a lot of money wasted. There's also a wind velocity meter you can get. Those are a little more expensive. You can get a small one, they're about 60, 70 bucks. But you can tell exactly how much wind or how much air is coming out of your ducting. Rather than, you know, guessing and doing a bunch of math, you just set this meter in front of your outlet and you can tell what's happening. Very, very, very simple. But I'm very obviously very big on meters. Here's another one. Lights. I saw another lamp out here, I don't remember the name, there was a big advertisement for them. But it's real similar to this, and the fixture was, for this 1,000-watt double-ended HID lamp, sodium lamp, and they were developed by Gavita Holland. There's Gavita Netherlands, which is the agricultural part, and Gavita Holland, which is the cannabis part. They separated them out, but this Theo Dextra, he's the director of the company, and he's got this UberSphere, which is, it tests the entire lamp, and it's the most scientific way to test, you know, how bright the lamp is and get the most readings. And it's hooked up to a computer and everything's documented quite well. Gavita is top of the line. They're Dutch guys and they have no sense of humor when it comes to science. It's either this way or not. And then here we've got the LEDs. There's always a lot of outrageous claims. You got to be careful with them. LEDs are, gosh, lighting and diodes. You see them everywhere. There's some really simple physical principles that are hard to overcome, like the light diminishes to the square of the distance. So they've got to be very, very bright. There's a good chapter in here. I could go into it, but it gets real. A lot of people won't be interested, and you won't remember all of the stuff that I say. So it's best to read it. And I've got a lot on the website too, marijuanagrowing.com. But Cree and Osram are the two best manufacturers. A lot of the other ones are made in China and they're just substandard. But look for those two, Cree and Osram. Here's another real cool one. This ultraviolet light, UV, A, B, and C. We'll see the one side at the end of the red end of the spectrum, the wavelengths are like this, really long. But on the other end, the ultraviolet side, they're quick, like this. And the A is slower, B is a little faster, and C is really quick. So what that does, when it hits the skin of anything, it bombards it and shakes it up. So you can use it to kill fungus and insects, eggs, whatever, and it won't hurt the plants. You gotta move it over real quickly. But you keep that over there for less of it. Half a second to maybe a second, but definitely not 2 seconds. You run that over your plants and they use it over there at Flowery Fields, and they've been using them all over Europe now. It'll keep all your plants super clean. It'll kill any eggs that are on there. It'll kill any fungus that's on there. They work great. They run that over there every couple of days. Wonderful stuff. Containers, super important. Good containers. You want root pruning containers. Whether it's one of those smart pots or geopods that breathe, and you can make your own. It's not rocket science to make them, but it's a lot easier to buy them. Or one of the pots that's got holes in the sides and prunes the roots. But you can see dynamic difference. These pots hold the same amount of soil. They're 11 liter pots, 3 gallon pots, but you can see the one has a root mass about a third the size of the other one. And just by purchasing the proper pot, you get a third more root mass and a bigger plant. And it costs you a few pennies just to do that. Keep the pot and use it over and over. Very inexpensive. Irrigation, Dosatron, or there's several other ones. Dosatron's really a popular one. But if you grow a lot of plants outdoors, you might want to use a Dosatron because it keeps all your fertilization consistent. There's a few quirks about this one. You've got to make sure that the flow of liquid is enough because it puts a little bit of fertilizer on and then the water comes through a little fertilizer. So you have to have enough flow in there to get an accurate mix. That's something to remember when you go buy these, because normally they don't tell you that. There's a couple other things, but that's probably the most important. Organics, this plant is organic. We know that because the bird told us. This little hummingbird tells us. And if you've got birds in your garden, you know, if you've got amphibious animals in there, frogs, snakes, whatever, it's going to be organic. The more organic attracts predators. This one, though, is sucking up some resin. Pretty interesting photos taken by a good friend of mine, Doobie Duck, lives in Northern California. Nutrients, the basics are essential. You got to really pay attention to this. You've got mobile and immobile nutrients. Mobile nutrients move to where the problem is. And immobile nutrients, like nitrogen, for example, it does not move. So that's a basic distinction. You have to make that distinction. And then you distinguish that when you're solving a problem, and you've already, you've narrowed it down to just half the nutrients. It's great. And then also accurate analysis is super, super important, soil analysis. Rather than guessing what's in your soil, get it tested. It's like 30 to $50, depending on the test. You can go for more, but It's really cheap, and you'll save a ton of money. But anyway, there's a lot of things when you look at nutrients too, because they can be confused with a lot of different things. And that's one of the things I'm big on is saying what they can be confused with and how they're confused. But this, you know, on this you can see excess and deficiency. I've also got a big chart that I've got on my website that's quite detailed, and it just has this mouse doesn't look great on here, but it's just got this part on it. It doesn't have the detailed descriptions. But sometimes the deficiency and excesses have the same symptoms, so they're quite difficult to figure out. And also, you always want to look at the roots. You have some real big problems with the roots. But many times, nutrient deficiencies are a product of imbalanced pH or a buildup of nutrients in the soil. Here's another one, keep it clean. These guys thought they were brilliant. They had a rock wool cubes, and they put it on a capillary mat, and everything's wet, and it grows algae. The algae competes for the oxygen in the water, and it starves the plants. So it's everything's backwards. It's backwards. And then once that algae gets in there, fruit flies come in. Well, not fruit flies. Well, fruit flies, and then the little what do you call those? The little they jump. They're members of the spring family. They fungus gnats. Fungus gnats are all over there. You put your face up close, and they start flying up your nose. It's horrible. And you can see, you know, everything's filthy in the nutrient tank. And it doesn't matter how much air that you throw in that tank, it will be consumed by the algae. It'll be gone. You know, can't supply enough oxygen. Here's one of my mentors, Mel Frank, in his garden. I was finally able to take pictures of him. But he's done tons of reading, and he's another one of the unsung heroes that never made a lot of money. He just likes to grow, and gosh, he's a great writer too, great photographer. And here's another guy, another black sheep. His family's from Croatia, and all of his family are pharmacists except for him. He moved to the Canary Islands and started growing. Now he's got the biggest medical dispensary in the Canary Islands. Yeah, Michael, great guy. And the reason I put him in is he's got a bag on his arm. So remember the plant that had the Planned Parenthood, the bud that comes out? Well, that's this bag is a sleeve that goes over there. And the cool part about it is it's got a window in it, so you can look at the plant and make sure that everything, the pollen, is dispersed properly. And then it's tied off on one end. Here's another couple photos. This is Madeline Martinez. She has the USA World Famous Cannabis Cafe. It's a long name. And also she's a national director or board member in Normal, and Oregon Normal member. But she's got a syringe of Rick Simpson oil in here. And you can, I don't have enough time now to talk about that, but you can look that up on the internet, Rick Simpson. And then Blueberry Dan, DJ Short, this is a bottle of tincture that he's made. And see, and I guess I didn't put the, but he's got the guaranteed analysis on it, which is quite important. Okay, I still got some more time. I sped up for this because I wanted to talk a bit. Well, I'll talk about this. Here we were in 1983. When I first published this book, I had to self-publish it. I had to rent time. I had to print it myself. I had absolutely no money. It was 96 pages, 8.5 by 5.5, 8.5 format. Nobody would publish it. They said it wasn't necessary. Everything, but we already knew everything about marijuana we needed to know. So the first year, 1983, I went out and sold it myself face to face. It sold 6,000 copies, and that's a lot of books at the time. And then I was able to go to the next step and have somebody else, an actual printer, print it for me, and it sold way better since then. But I was underground the whole time. In 2005, I made videos with High Times. A lot of people have seen them. I saw somebody had the three-pack of them out here. But I had to wear a disguise, you know, in my own country. I couldn't show my face in my own country. It really pisses me off. I have to be somebody else in my own country, you know? I can't show my face here. And then I go to Europe, I'm okay. Nobody cares, you know? That's why I moved there 18 years ago. And then now, though, I come back to America, this is 2014, I come back, and this one ran in Washington Post. And so I can show my face, and it's a point of pride, and I'm glad everybody here can show their face. We don't have to be afraid anymore. It's a good thing. It's a good thing. So now I can show you about, I love outdoor growing, I love the sunlight, and I love growing big plants. I can't grow big plants at my house anymore because, well, I live in a suburban area and all the neighbors complain they smell too much, and I can only build the fence 8 feet high, and I got to keep them under 8 feet, and that's pretty hard. So I profiled a friend's greenhouse, and all of these are case study number four. But you can grow. I was just over at Paul Stanford's backyard, one of the places he grows. He's got plants. Some of them are almost up to the ceiling. They definitely will go as high as this bar here. And he's in Portland, Oregon. The climate's super similar. You can grow big plants here, no worries. People say you can't, they're wrong. I've seen it with my own eyes, it is true. It is much less expensive and more efficient. There's a lot of times you won't get like the super resinous, showy buds, but they're every bit as potent. Anyway, these plants were started in Northern California. Yeah, I just put a few of them in. Okay, they're grown out. First they were started indoors, then they're moved outdoors into a greenhouse. And the biggest problem when you move them out is temperature, because the soil temperature and the ambient temperature in the air, it's too cold. So they get shocked for about 2 weeks, depending on your temperature level. But once they acclimate, they take off. The key is to get these plants in early. A lot of times they'll start in January or February, either from seed or clone. And then here's some other plants. These plants were a lot bigger, they're growing. This is just an outbuilding with plastic on the sides and the roof. And they have lights and everything. But the lights, these are all the CFL lamps. And that's just to keep them from flowering, to keep them with, to interrupt the nighttime dark cycle so they'll stay flowering. And you can see here. So that's what they're for. And you have to set those up. But you can buy these fixtures quite inexpensively at the home improvement centers. Then they take these plants and they make sure they're, 2 to 3 feet tall. If they can be that tall when you put them out in March, maybe as late as April in this climate, put them out there. And these are grown in the ground, or you can put them up in pots. Pots stay a little bit warmer. You get about an extra month earlier time, but there's other complications. Like it's expensive to grow in pots. I prefer to grow on the ground, and then you can develop. You can really make a nice organic soil there and keep it, keep the soil alive, and it's way less expensive. It's way easier. And if it's easy, you can grow more. You can grow a lot more plants and you're more efficient. You do a better job. But you see, this is a simple hoop house. There's just some rebar pieces of steel stuck in the ground here. They stretch the schedule 40 pipe over the top, and then they attach it right here. It's a little serpentine here. But you can either attach this with cable ties or duct tape. So it's really inexpensive. And then the plastic, you can roll it up and save it for another year. There's quite a bit of technical information about plastic, so that I really won't go into now, not enough time. But see, and then here, these are in pots. These are, I think, 200-gallon pots. And they're a little bit ahead of the other plants. But they do real well, and like I say, early on the big deal is soil temperature. Later they'll put mulch over the top of these right here. But the early in the year you want the sun to hit it so it warms it, but later you want to cool it with the mulch, and that's essential. It's really cheap. I use straw rather than alfalfa. Alfalfa hay, it decomposes too quickly, but it's got a lot of nitrogen, about 15 to 18% normally. And then after it starts warming up, you can either take the plastic off, manually take it off. It's a little bit of work, not bad. And put it off to the side. put something on it so the wind won't blow it, and then put it on at night. So it's super inexpensive. You can do this in your backyard, right? And remember, put them on at least 12-foot centers, minimum, 12-foot centers. That'll give it 6 feet in either direction to grow out. Now they're putting them on 18 to 20-foot centers because these plants are already touching. Okay, and then you see these greenhouses, or hoop houses, they call them. They make them as long as you want. And then afterwards, you put this. I like the plastic netting rather than the nylon netting. The plastic netting, though, a lot of times you can reuse it, but a lot of times people just cut it up and recycle it. The nylon netting, it's flimsy, and you've got to stretch it, so that's why this netting is much better. This netting serves as a trellis. And all you have to do is hook it down here, attach it down here with a cable tie or a piece of duct tape on either side. The plants grow through this, the wind comes and it holds them up. It's great, and it's fast, efficient, and inexpensive. Those are all like major words in my vocabulary. And then here you can see it's also already growing through. These plants, you get a lot of rain on your plants. They can take a lot of rain with this. The branches won't break, or they'll break very seldom. And if it rains hard, you go out and shake your plants every day so the rain doesn't sit down in the crevices and stuff. But works great. And then, well, here's one of the plants. As you can see, the leaves grow pretty big. Okay, and then later, you can put a second layer over. These, they got really big. See, the top here, the crown of this, that's about as tall as my head. So this plant's almost two of me. These plants will definitely go to the ceiling. This plant will harvest out just dry, trimmed buds at somewhere between 8 and 10 pounds. But, okay, so the second layer, you get a big long stick, like one of those extending paint poles, you know, for painting the ceiling. You get one of those and you put a hook on it, on the end, and then you just pick this up and the netting up and you put it over the top. So you've got two layers of that. And these plants, I mean, very seldom do you ever see a broken branch. Very seldom, it's great. Here's another great trick. I don't know if you've got the seeds, I just haven't grown up here for so long, and I didn't know all of this when I lived in the Northwest. These plants, this one here, the purple one, that's already been harvested once. And it was about as big as this green one is here, right? So what they did is, and this was in southern Humboldt County, which is a lower latitude than here, and it's got a great growing climate, stays warm longer in the year. So what they did, and they still have adequate sunlight, they cut the top 2 feet of this off. Because one of the problems you run into is when you grow a lot of plants is you've got to dry them, and you've got to dry them really fast to get the next plants in and the next one. So you've got to stagger your harvest so you don't run out of drying area and you keep your crews busy. But here, it takes them 3 months to harvest all these plants, right? But they take the top 2 feet off, process those, get them dry, and then about two to three weeks later, they take another 2 feet off. And these secondary buds, well, now they're primary buds. They get great big. And if you're fortunate enough, you're just this simple tactic, you will get, they got up to 40% more on their plants. But they had two to four different harvests they could make. Up here, guaranteed, it'll pick up your harvest 10%. Just by doing that, and it costs you nothing, zero. Okay, here's another one, maybe, I don't know, a lot of people have seen this one all around the world. This is a 10-pounder here. There was a lot of 10-pounders that came out of that garden that year. The average weight was 8.6 pounds, I think, average for all the plants. That year, I can tell you now because 2 years ago, he grew over 2,200 pounds of dried cannabis buds, you know. And with minimum amount of money, minimum amount of fertilizer, minimum amount of work.